This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
As our fathers did before, we shall win this unwanted war, and our children will enjoy the future we'll be giving.
That was Jack Buck. About a week later, it was September 17th of 2001 when Major League Baseball resumed play after the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. We are 24 years removed from that event, which happened in New York City, a plane crashing in Pennsylvania and in Washington, D.C. as well. And a journalist and lecturer at Yale, former managing editor of The Wall Street Journal, is Joanne Lippman. She was there at the World Trade Center when the first plane hit, and she joins us now on KMOX. Joanne, it's good to talk to you, and we appreciate you taking the time today. How are you?
I'm just fine. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be with you.
Yeah, we're glad to talk to you, and we didn't expect that the news would be what it was yesterday. It's been kind of a pretty difficult 24 hours. Less than 24 hours actually since yesterday. We kind of figured that we would just be remembering 9/11 today and talking about it. So we know that this event for you was very, very personal. Could you tell people where you were when this all happened?
Sure. So on that morning, at the time, I was a senior editor at the Wall Street Journal, and our office, our headquarters, was directly across the street from the World Trade Center. My subway stop was in the World Trade Center. And as it happened, my daughter's birthday was and is the next day, September 12th. And that morning, I was shopping inside the World Trade Center. They had shops in that bottom level for a birthday present. And I was with a colleague of mine. And suddenly, everybody's evacuated from the building. And no one really knew what was happening at that time. And when we got out on the street and saw this massive gash at the top of the towers, first of all, nobody actually assumed at that time, if you put yourself in that mindset back then, nobody even imagined it was a terror attack. I heard people say, it was a sightseeing airplane that got lost, or somebody else said it was a helicopter. I was sure it was a helicopter. Nobody thought this was intentional, but it was a horrific, horrific aviation accident. That's what we thought at the time. And I will tell you, it was the most horrendous sight you can imagine of, cars pulled up every which way. I remember there was a taxi cab with a chunk of concrete on top of it that had fallen. And things were still falling from the sky when we emerged from that building. It looked like it was snowing. It was a clear blue sky, but it seemed like snow that was falling. It was a very bizarre scene. The snow, of course, was pulverized steel and concrete. And there were also financial papers that were wafting down from the upper floors. And my colleague and I, we assumed this was a terrible aviation accident. We're like, we got to get to the office. And that was when, on our way to attempt to get to the office, that we saw actually the real destruction, which actually came out the other end of the building. The plane had gone through, had flung sort of all of everything, the people, the airplane parts, everything had been flung forward. And when we tried to get to our office, that's what we encountered. And I don't really want to describe exactly what we saw, but no human should see the things that we encountered. It was a horrific sight of what happens when a plane smashes and throws bodies onto the street. We were trying to get to our office, and we were just in front of the second tower, the South Tower, when we heard a plane, the loud plane, like right over our heads. And we thought, great, they're like, it's going to rescue the people stuck at the top of the tower. We thought it was a rescue plane. And then suddenly there was just this massive explosion, just an explosion, like I can't even describe, sonic boom. You could feel it. And everybody who was on that street just ran and flattened themselves against the building. And it was a instinct, like a base instinct. There was no thought to it. Nobody looked up at the sky. It was just your basic primitive brain telling you that the sky is about to fall on your head, and you go and you flatten yourself. And it was only then that we realized that we were under attack. And at that moment, by the way, where the second plane came in, your assumption is first you realize you're under attack, and secondly, you say, what's next? And the people who were down there, that was the primary thought. This has happened now. What might be coming after this? We were able to escape on foot. We had to go underneath the burning buildings, which are very close to the river. So everybody like us who was escaping on foot basically hugged the river with this kind of idea in your head that if the towers fell over, which is what it looked like they would, you could jump in the water. Or if another attack came in, you could jump in the water. I mean, this is the thought process when you're in the midst of it. It was being in a battle. It was very hard to comprehend what was happening. Another colleague of mine actually took some photos of that group of people who were fleeing from the site. And you see the burning towers in the back and nobody looking at them. But I think it was just so hard to process that the people who were leaving the site couldn't process what was happening and were just kind of staring straight ahead, trying to just and walking, not running, just like they looked like refugees from a war-torn country that were just so shell-shocked that it was just your brain, kind of your conscious brain is sort of turning off, and you're just like, your body is telling you, you got to get out of this place. It was horrific. But I will say, the Wall Street Journal came through in the most brilliant way that day. Brilliant.
We're speaking with Joanne Lipman, a journalist, Yale lecturer, and former managing editor of the Wall Street Journal. As you heard her detailing, she was in one of the World Trade Center towers when the first plane hit. And because so many people see things on social media, Joanne, there is a clip of a man on TikTok kind of recapping some of your story, and it shows a picture of a receipt. And this receipt for the store that you said you were at on that concourse level of the World Trade Center, you bought some magnets for your daughter. The receipt is the time on it is stamped 9 minutes after the first plane hit, which speaks to kind of what you were saying. You're buying these magnets, and people didn't quite realize what was going on because there is such a ruckus in New York all the time. There are noises, and people didn't realize the magnitude of what was going on. And when you left that building, you walked into a different world, a world forever changed.
That's right. And actually, it kind of speaks to the jaded New Yorker in some of us, which was, I was online at the cash register. My daughter was 10. Her birthday was the next day. She wanted refrigerator magnets, and I had finally found the refrigerator magnets. And I was online when the place was being evacuated, and the cashier was like, something's going on. We got to get out of here. And I said, I'm not leaving until we ring up the refrigerator magnets. It's my daughter's birthday. We were sort of that jaded. We assumed if there was something going on, it was either a false alarm or it was something minor. We'd never experienced anything of that magnitude, obviously. And actually, my colleague and I, who were there, and the cashier, we were among the last people who actually left the building. And that receipt was, I believe it was 9 minutes after that the plane had struck.
You know, Joanne, you wrote about this day, and it's in a piece. You can read it at Yahoo News, Katie Couric Media. It's available if you want to find it online. And one of the things that you point out is the front page of the Wall Street mm-hmm. Journal the next day, and how the headline is "Terrorists Destroy World Trade Center, Hit Pentagon in Raid with Hijacked Jets." And the thing that you noted is on that front page, nowhere on it are Democrats blaming President Bush, Republicans trying to shift blame away from President Bush or the administration, that it was all just about the event that happened, that it wasn't, we didn't immediately go into defense mode and defense of the parties or blame on the other side. That seems very unheard of today. It feels nuts that happened, and it was like that 24 years ago, and things were very, very different then.
Yes, I'm really glad you brought that up. So first of all, I have to say my colleagues at the Wall Street Journal were heroic, were amazing that day, because our office was pretty much destroyed. People had Blackberries, and there was no iPhone yet. People had Blackberries, and every single person just became a reporter. Didn't matter what their job was in the organization. Everybody was doing interviews, and they were doing eyewitness accounts and all kinds of things, and they didn't know who, because our boss actually was missing at that time, didn't even know who to send this reporting to. So they just sent it to the entire organization. And then, you know, other people got to New Jersey and set up instantly, somehow set up a makeshift newsroom because our building was pretty much destroyed. It was amazing what they did and what everyone came together and created this newspaper that was able to come out the next day, which itself was a miracle. But when I show this to my students at Yale, they're astonished to see that there's no finger pointing. There's no blaming. There's no politics. It's really, you know, if you look at the headlines, it's about a nation stands in mourning and disbelief, right? It's the nation. It's unified. And it really is a reminder of a time when when people trusted the press, first of all, the majority of Americans at that time still trusted the media. And also when neither people, you know, news consumers nor the media, people were not looking at everything through a political lens, a polarized lens. That happened after 9/11. And you know, it was a time when, you know, there was more national unity. I mean, I will say, you know, there was a lot of problems. Yeah, there were conspiracy theories. There was some terrible violence against Muslims or people who looked like Muslims after 9/11. The mainstream press, though, didn't buy into the conspiracies. They gave them no oxygen. They didn't publicize them. And there was no social media that was going to sort of, you know, elevate these conspiracy theories or the hatred or the vitriol. And so it was a different time. And I show this to students, and it's really hard for them to even imagine a world that isn't so polarized. Mm.
Joanne, in your piece, as Ranj mentioned, you can read Katie Couric Media, Yahoo News. You describe what you saw a little bit, just how graphic there was, as you can imagine. Like you said, you're not going to get into the details, but the bodies, the death, the parts of the plane. And you went to work reporting. How did you go into work mode? And how long was it before you were able, as a human with emotions, able to process the horrors that you saw?
That's such a great question, because the first thing that happened is you're immediately in work mode, like instantly in work mode as a journalist. And I actually say that those of us who were journalists, those of us at the Wall Street Journal, we had a mission. We were on a mission. And it was actually very helpful in getting through that trauma, because we felt like we had a purpose and that we were contributing something by trying to understand and help others and shed light on these events. And we were so focused on that that it was very helpful. But I will say that there were a lot of people who, you know, had very much lasting trauma afterward. I think to this day there are people who are still dealing with that trauma. For me, I think the healthiest thing I could possibly do for my own mental health was to keep working.
And for those of you know who also survived it, went through this, does it feel like, and I mean, clearly you're always going to be affected by this for the rest of your life. This is one of the most traumatic things to ever happen in this country, really anywhere in the world. I mean, it was an awful, awful day for those of us who remember it. But getting past it, do you feel like there's some of that there has been an ability that you can move forward in a really meaningful way from it?
You know, it will always be an absolutely seminal moment in my life and in the lives of others who were directly experiencing it or were impacted by it, without question. I will also say, though, professionally as a journalist, it was, I think, the proudest moment of my life in terms of pride in the work that my colleagues were doing, in how everybody came together, the journalists that I worked with came together with such a sense of mission and purpose. And the work that was done was extraordinary under unbelievably difficult, extraordinary circumstances. And so, you know, that also stays with me. I think the thing that is a little bit, to me, a little discombobulating is I've been teaching at Yale now for 5 years. And when I first started teaching 5 years ago, there were still students who at least were born by the time 9/11 happened and whose families maybe were impacted by it. By this year, 5 years later, none of those students had been born. And I feel like when I'm telling them about it, it almost feels like they're looking at me like I'm a World War II veteran. Like it happened before they were alive. It's ancient history for them, which is a bizarre and discomforting kind of feeling.
Yeah, we've been talking about that, and I've been talking about it for a couple of years now, just that there are people alive now that have zero memory of it. And that's wild to me because it was so real at the time. And it's hard to imagine there are people who don't have memories of it. Joanne Lippman, journalist,
right?
Lecturer at it's crazy. Managing editor, former managing editor with the Wall Street Journal. Thank you for telling your story to us today. It was, I think people really liked hearing from you on this.
I appreciate that. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
That is Joanne Lippman with us. And you can read that piece. She wrote about it. Yahoo's got it. So if you want to find it on Yahoo News, it is right there for you to read. Joanne Lippman, a journalist with us on 104.1 FM KMOX.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Chris and Amy on KMOX, Gas House Gang coming up at 12 o'clock. Bernie Miklas and me, we will be with you today. We'll talk some Redbirds, and sure, we will have more for you on that show. Not sure we will have more for you than just Cardinals talk today, but we will talk a lot of Cardinals starting at 12 o'clock.
Yeah. Matt, I mean, obviously for people who've been listening, it's been a heavy day. Like, it's a heavy day. And I mentioned my friends earlier that are in Evergreen and making sure their family was safe.
Where the school shooting was yesterday.
A school, yeah,
in Colorado.
Shooting. The shooter, the suspect, self-inflicted gunshot wound, and two children injured. But it's one of those things, Ranj, where I think things like this should force us to slow down. I think it's good to get offline, talk to your family, talk to your friends, talk to your neighbors, and hug your family and your friends and your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just be human, and we could all benefit from being a little bit less social media crazy, a little bit less online, getting outside, because there is so much hurt in the world, and even in tough times, all of us have things to be grateful for, you know, whether it's your child or your spouse or the ability to step outside. And I think that's something that in this moment, we can all do our part. I mean, America is made up of Americans. We're all people. Neighborhoods are made up of neighbors. Communities are made up of people. And we can all do our part in bringing down the temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And rehumanizing each other.
Well, it's going to have to be, as we started with today, a recognition from everybody that it needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And we need, you know what, we need to just stop right now with, it's their fault. Oh, it's their fault. Look, nothing is going to change as long as we continue that, because there's not ever going to be an arbiter that says, yep, it is in fact this political party's fault that everything sucks. And that is that's the final word right there. So in order for us to solve the actual violent tendencies, we're all just going to have to say stop right now. That's all there is to it. It goes on. It does go on both sides. It may not necessarily be equal, but it does go on both sides, and it needs to quit now. It has to. And I agree with you. And I think the vast majority of people do agree that they don't believe people who vote differently for them are the enemy. Yeah. Or that they are out to get you. I think there are people, most definitely, in politics or in the public sphere, who have bad intentions, who argue in bad faith. I think that does happen. But the vast majority of Americans just want what's good for themselves and for their neighbors. And the sooner we recognize that, and the sooner that those people get loud, the better off we're going to be. And that's what it's going to have to take, I think.
Maybe
people who are just right there, not necessarily in the middle, but even if you're left-leaning or right-leaning, but also not insane, get loud. Get loud and say, let's calm this all down.
Yeah, and having serious conversations that political violence is not the answer. That's not... it's un-American. It is not American to resort to violence. When I talk about ideologically, it's not American.
Mm-hmm.
We should roundly continue to condemn the CEO killing the United CEO. We're a little too frivolous sometimes. Like, oh, Luigi Mangione. Oh, he did. Oh, and I saw a lot of people who were very, very flippant with the murder of that United Healthcare CEO, because somehow in their minds they could justify violence. You could call it political or, you know, healthcare based, whatever. We need to shut down any type of flippancy or gloating or glorification of violence, and full stop. And have more serious conversations and not get used to making light of a murder like the United CEO.
If you want to beat the other side, if you want to call them the other side, if you want to beat them in ideas, great. Beat them with your ideas, but it can't be done like this. It can't be done with murder. And once we start going down that path, we are screwed, man. If that's what it is, if that's what we turn into, we are screwed. It cannot go this way. Amy Mark's course, Chris Ranji. Feel free to text into the show if you would like to. Voice messages on the Odyssey app as well. When we come back, NBC News, National Law Enforcement and Intelligence Correspondent Tom Winter will join the show. We'll find out what Tom knows about the suspect. They have images of him now. They apparently have the weapon, or at least they believe they have the weapon. They have palm prints, they say, footprints. We will see what Tom Winter knows when we come back on KMOX.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys?
Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
The killing of Charlie Kirk yesterday in Utah is still the big news of the day, and we continue to cover it and bring to you what we know and what we are learning, and developments have happened this morning. To tell us more about that, the National Law Enforcement and Intelligence Correspondent for NBC News, Tom Winter, joins the show. We appreciate your time, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing well, Chris. How are you? Of course, I say I'm personally doing well. This obviously would have been a tough day for our country, given the 24th anniversary of 9/11. As I sit here and speak with you, they're still reading the names at Ground Zero. And then obviously yesterday's news is just compounds upon that because of obviously what it portends for targeted violence and political violence in our country.
We are continuing to see updates from national news outlets about a person of interest. The Utah Department of Public Safety and the FBI released a photo of someone they're calling a person of interest in connection with the shooting. It has been reported that a rifle has been recovered in the nearby woods. Can you let us know, what do we know so far regarding the rifle, ammunition, and person of interest?
Yeah, sure, Amy. We received an update approximately 9 a.m. Eastern time, and we were on the Today Show talking about it then. And in the course of that, what officials have said, and I'm going to incorporate information from Utah state authorities as well as the FBI in Utah, that yesterday they were able to, in the hours overnight, come across some surveillance camera video that they have. They've put out two images now of a person they're describing as a person of interest. And one of the photos appears to be from a stairwell. And in fact, at that press conference, they said they recovered a video from the stairwell of the building where this individual apparently fired at Charlie Kirk. He goes up on the roof, fires that shot, and then flees by actually jumping off the roof, and then goes into a wooded area in a neighborhood nearby the university. That's where they recover this bolt-action, high-powered rifle, as they described it. Then seen going through the neighborhood, and as you all know, these days so many people have the ring cameras, the various surveillance cameras on their houses, and so that allows them to kind of track the movements. You see them on a camera at one house, okay, what's the next house over, or the house across the street? Do they have a camera? You track that next movement, and so it's really just shoe leather work that detectives and investigators are doing, and at the same point in time, they're trying to use what are some of the most basic techniques in being a detective to then use the best technology they have, whether or not they can get an image that works for facial recognition. They'll analyze where the cell phones are in that area and be able to try and see, okay, what cell phones were in use What cell phones were in use at the time at the university? Are there any that are then in use in that neighborhood? Can they start to triangulate if this individual has their cell phone on? There's some ways around that too. So look, it's high tech meets low tech, old fashioned investigative work, but it's where we're at now, which is they believe they have good images of this individual. They've released those images of a person of interest, and now they've got to try to find out who this person is and where they're at. This becomes one of the most dangerous parts of the investigation, because now whoever did this knows that there are images out there. And if it in fact is that person, they're going to know that that they've got some heat on them. And that's a time where sometimes people can act out. I'm referring specifically to the Sarnaev brothers in Boston, what they did once the images were released there. And on the other hand, maybe has this person kind of go to ground. But typically it's helpful. They'll get the tips from the public. And hopefully we're looking at an arrest here soon and a successful charges. Obviously, this investigation has moved forward significantly overnight and into the morning today, and that's just the information they've given to us, because as you both know, what they've told us so far is probably lagging where they actually are in the case.
So the images of the alleged shooter, we believe it's him, the weapon, they believe they have the weapon. At what point do they, in the investigation, start thinking about motive? It's all about catching him now. When do they get to the part where they think about motive? We heard about messages written on bullets. We've seen the T-shirt that he's wearing. It's really hard to see what's on it, but there is an image on it, a hat, too, that he's wearing. So when do they get to the point where motive is the priority?
You know, that's something that can be helpful in trying to find somebody. So that's not something that is, you know, certainly, obviously, as you alluded to, Chris, the priority is finding this person. They do not believe that there's a broader threat to the public. They believe that this individual, this was a targeted killing specific to Charlie Kirk. Obviously, given the fact that they would have had the opportunity to fire on other individuals there, and in fact, only fired the one round at Kirk, helps inform that opinion. But you want to find this person. On the other hand, if you can look at motive and there's something about this person, their ideology, where they come from, why did they specifically go after Kirk? Perhaps that can help you in trying to find them. So I don't think it takes a complete backseat as you're trying to find this individual. Certainly, you're hoping throughout the course of this that they can take him into custody. Their belief is that if they can do that, then they can bring a case. Motive becomes critical at that point. Obviously, there'll be a state homicide charge. But depending upon the motive, that could also potentially bring federal charges into play. So that's something that they're clearly going to be focused on. We have not heard anything definitive on the motive. They are looking into whether or not there were any sort of writings on any sort of on the ammunition shell casings. If that is borne out to be true, that's a troubling trend, because it'll be the third time in the last 9 months that somebody has written messages on ammunition or on magazines. We saw it, of course, in the shooting of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, which is just about 3.5-4 blocks from where I am sitting right now. And the person that they've charged in that case, in Luigi Mangione, you saw it a couple of weeks ago with that horrible school shooting that took place during a Catholic mass at a school and church in Minneapolis. And then if that's the case here today, this is part of a trend, people trying to speak out. And by the way, the analysis of these individuals that's occurring by the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit and other units, it's very clear that these individuals study what other shooters and what other people that are acting out in targeted violence, study what they're doing. And so this is now, if in fact is the case, is a very troubling trend.
At this point of an investigation, how open are investigators, FBI, local law enforcement, to all possibilities of what, you know, I think about this, and this is more conspiratorial, but it's very likely that it's just a domestic person who wanted to do this and, you know, has an ideology, whether it's left or right, whatever it is. And there's also the possibility, because we know foreign governments do benefit from unrest that happens here sometimes, the possibility that he was put up to it by a foreign entity. Is that a thing that they look at, or are they just pretty much focusing on a domestic motive?
Great question. 100% something they're looking at. They were asked that question specifically while we were on the air on NBC Nightly News last night about the idea of any sort of foreign connection. They said no comment. That's not a yes. It's not a no. They're clearly looking at that. And yes, given what we've seen, just to kind of back up why this is a concern, we have seen foreign governments try to get involved in U.S. politics. We do know that governments like Iran have tried to carry out recently initiatives on U.S. soil. So certainly the idea by foreign governments is to sow discord in the United States, to get us to be fired up and riled up in a violent way at each other. So given the fact that, you know, that's the type of incident that we have here, we have something that is highly political charged, a well-known activist and commentator on the conservative side of things, that's something that has to be looked at. Have we seen any evidence of that so far? No, but, you know, there's no evidence to discount that at the moment, just based on what we know publicly from officials.
Tom, you were talking about being on the Today Show reporting with NBC, and one, I think, of the kind of the phenomenons of the modern social media age is that these very graphic videos of events like this, specifically of Charlie Kirk's assassination, it's circulating on social media. Now, news outlets use their discretion on what they're going to show on television. NBC, I'm sure, had to make decisions of how much they would show. How has social media and the way that these videos can just be shared to millions of people, how has that changed how a news outlet like NBC makes decisions on the video?
Yeah, I think, you know, you have your own standards as a reporter, and then those fall in line with our organizational standards. You look at the videos that were out there yesterday, they're highly graphic. Mm-hmm. They show the actual moment of the shooting and its immediate aftermath. A very difficult video to watch. I think there's a lot of concern in the law enforcement community about these videos because for several reasons. There's a desensitized impact on the population that people will watch these videos and kind of become desensitized to violence. And so, well, I did that. You know, this person did that. I could do that. That's a concern. There's also the idea that some of the social media algorithms will see you watching that and say, oh, that's an area of interest. I can feed more of that to you. And of course, that has a tremendous impact. And then the impact that it has on kids and on young adults. So you look at this and law enforcement looks at it and says, this is information that is coming directly, being piped directly into the phones of these kids. What impact does that have as far as being able to compute that violence? It's very difficult. And so it's a huge concern in the law enforcement community. It's a huge concern among people that cover it. You know, here, you just look at the basic, if it was your family member, what would you want to do? And so it's not really relevant to the story to show you a horrible aftermath. What does that do to our understanding of it? It really doesn't do a whole heck of a lot. We know that there's been a fatality here. There's been an assassination. So you have to factor all of those things into play, just given how inflammatory the videos are and just the sensitivity of the audience. So it's a fine line, obviously, between, you know, not showing the actual incident and the gravity of it, because that has an impact, but also just doing the right thing by the family. So I can't recall an incident where we've shown the fatal shooting of an individual, at least in my recent memory. And I think they're evaluated on a case-by-case basis, but we're certainly sensitive to that.
Tom Winter, national law enforcement and intelligence correspondent for NBC News. Appreciate it. Really good stuff today, and we thank you for the reporting.
Thank you both.
Amy Markscores and Chris Ranji on 104.1 FM KMOX. Of course, this station will continue to follow all the developments. They do have a suspect. They believe, well, they don't know who it is, but they know what they are looking for. They have images of him. They may have evidence, it appears, that's according to authorities right now. And if anything breaks today, this is the place you're going to want to be. We will have that news for you, and that is all day. If it doesn't happen in the next hour or so, it will happen. And when it does, we will bring it to you on 104.1 FM KMOX. You are always welcome to join the show by texting in at 314-436-7900. Voice messages on the Odyssey app, and it's super simple to do that. If you've got the Odyssey app, which is what you use on your phone to listen to the station live and Cardinals baseball live and all of that, podcasts as well when the show's over, all available for you. But you can record a message and send it. There's a button that says, you know, record a message or leave a message. It's really easy to do that. We love to get those from you. This text message from a 217, which I believe it's Springfield, Illinois. That's a 217 area code. It says, thank you, Ranj and Amy. We need our politicians to work together to make laws and regulations for our country. We need them to reduce crime and keep our citizens safe from murder and violence. When they start doing that job we elected them for, and working across the aisle with each other, is when our country will be saved. Otherwise, we are doomed to destroy it from within, which no outsider could do. Shaking my head as this bitter fight between politicians has to end, and democracy and debate on any matter is what this country was built on. Does not matter what religion you practice or what color your skin is. We are all American, and we will need to start acting like we are a country that is united. And that's kind of the message that we've had all day, is that at some point we have to get to a place where we stop saying, because of them, your situation is awful. Because of them, the country is destroyed. I don't care who does it. I don't care who starts it. I don't care where the cycle ends, but the cycle has to end. And I think collectively what it will take is for all of us to go, okay, enough's enough. I'm done blaming the other side for everything. It's not working for us, and we're headed down a really lousy path.
Yeah. It's like I said, I keep thinking of our country, and for a long time, because we are geographically isolated from a lot of our geopolitical adversaries, you know, we're safe. We have our military. We're pretty safe. We are, as a country, historically and currently incredibly prosperous compared to so much of the suffering that's going on in the world. So we had the luxury for a long time of being pretty unserious. I think we propagated unseriousness. What I mean by that is foolishness, kind of resorting to base behaviors, making enemies of our neighbors. Maybe because we didn't have any enemies across the world that we thought about. I mean, seriously, you know, I mean, when I'm looking at Afghanistan and looking at what the women are going through there, where they could be killed for laughing or if their voices heard, they have no freedoms, just absolutely oppressed. Or you think of the Uyghurs in China who are living in concentration camps. I mean, these are serious issues. And somehow we became an unserious country on social media and in politics, and then it became very serious, and then it became existential, where, like the texter said, from within.
Yeah.
The call's coming from within the house. And I hope that this tragic event slows us down and kind of knocks us back into a sense of perspective that this was a country built on disagreement and debate, and we're going to disagree and debate each other, but political violence is absolutely not an answer. That only breaks down the cornerstones of democracy.
As I said a number of times, I don't know if I agreed with Charlie Kirk on much of anything, not even his baseball team. You know, not a team. Charlie, a big Cubs fan. Charlie grew up in the suburbs in Chicago, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that politically I disliked much of what he had to say. He did not deserve to die yesterday over that. If that is, in fact, what this was about, is his politics, he did not deserve that. Nobody does. Nobody deserves to die over their opinions. And we cannot become that.
We can't desensitize ourselves to it, and we can't be flippant with it.
So hopefully they find this person and he's brought to justice. And well, that he will be, unless he commits suicide or something, but he will be brought to justice. We appreciate you listening today on what was a day we didn't really want to do.
Yeah,
pretty heavy day here on KMOX. And
this episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.